Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, December 26th, 2016. How has President Barack Obama done in the battle against AIDS?
If we look back on more than a decade in the AIDS response and over 35 years with the epidemic writ large, what President Obama has done is maintained one of the most important, most impactful programs I think global development has ever seen.
And how do you decrease tensions between Dinka and Nuer?
We very much know that the best means of handling situations nowadays is community policy. We get some of these people who know, who understand their language. We talk to them.
We'll answer these questions and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Security Council defeated a U.S.-sponsored resolution that would have imposed an arms embargo and targeted sanctions on South Sudan on Friday, ignoring arguments made by the U.S. and the UN Secretary General that it would help diminish fighting and prevent mass atrocities. Carol Van Dam reports for VOA from Washington.
In order for the resolution to be adopted, it needed 9 yes votes and no veto by a permanent member of the Security Council. In Friday's vote, 7 council members voted for the resolution and 8 abstained, so it was not approved. Immediately following the vote, U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said the vote was meant to show that the architects of mass atrocities and those who defy the demands of the Security Council day in and day out will face consequences. Power and U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had been urging the Council to adopt the resolution for weeks. The 8 countries who abstained include Russia and China. Russia's Deputy UN Ambassador Peter Ilyichev said the U.S. was ignoring South Sudan's agreement in late November to allow the deployment of a regional protection force and President Salva Kiir's speech to Parliament earlier this month announcing a national reconciliation program. Ilyichev said, "We think it is abnormal when serious work on settling the situation in South Sudan is undermined by senseless use of the sanctions stick." He called the U.S. recommended policy short-sighted and warned of disastrous consequences if approved. Japan's UN ambassador, Koro Besho, who also abstained from Friday's vote, said his country believes it would be counterproductive to introduce additional sanction measures at a time when there has been some progress. He said Japan is, quote, encouraged by the demonstration of political will by the president, end quote, and urged Mr. Kiir to quickly translate the government's pledges into action. The defeated resolution would have imposed an arms embargo on a country already awash in weapons and sanctions on former First Vice President Riek Machar, as well as the Army Chief of Staff and South Sudan's Information Minister for fueling conflict and obstructing peace. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned again last week that South Sudan will be heading toward mass atrocities unless immediate action is taken to impose an embargo and pressure its leaders to end hate speech, incitement, and violence. Urging the Council to vote for the embargo, France's permanent representative to the UN said the embargo is not a punishment, but a leverage to prevent further violence, to protect civilians, and to foster an appeased political dialogue. And Matthew Rycroft, the UK's permanent representative to the UN, also urged the members to vote in favor of imposing an arms embargo, noting what he called the very clear warnings of the Secretary General's special advisor on the prevention of genocide about the risks. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
Barack Obama was the 2nd U.S. president to oversee PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. The program started under George W. Bush and is considered a great success in the battle against the disease. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports on Obama's PEPFAR legacy.
The president's emergency plan for AIDS relief began in 2004 with a 5-year, $15 billion commitment. The legislation creating it set funding priorities, including treatment, prevention, palliative care, and support for orphans and other children affected by HIV. The 2017 budget request for PEPFAR is nearly $6.8 billion, about $52 billion below 2016 funding. Most of the reduction comes in spending on tuberculosis, which is often a co-infection with HIV. Of the 18 million people currently on antiretroviral treatment, PEPFAR has helped about 11 million of them receive the life-saving drugs. Supporters say PEPFAR, the global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and others, have saved millions of lives. While PEPFAR is considered a major accomplishment of President Bush, how has it fared under the stewardship of President Obama? Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization AVAC, says it's done pretty well.
PEPFAR continues to be absolutely remarkable. If we look back on more than a decade in the AIDS response and over 35 years with the epidemic writ large, what President Obama has done is maintained one of the most important, most impactful programs I think global development has ever seen.
Warren says PEPFAR has grown beyond the Bush legacy.
As Obama's term comes to an end, we now can truly see that PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Response for AIDS Relief, is actually President's plural. It is no longer just a George Bush program that continues. It is truly a program that has continued a legacy of U.S. government and U.S. presidential support.
Nevertheless, he says, it could be better. For example, while 18 million people are on treatment, more than 38 million worldwide are infected.
Is the program perfect? No, no program is. Is the program funded as well as we would like it? No, it could use more resources. But if you look at the return on investment, so to speak, under the 8 years of the Obama administration, President Obama's leadership and the leadership of his two ambassadors, Eric Goosby and Debbie Birx, has actually been remarkable and remarkably good.
Doctors Goosby and Birx each served as the U.S. Global AIDS coordinator and presided over PEPFAR. Warren says PEPFAR is getting a good return on its investment because tougher economic times demanded it.
Funding didn't grow as much as we would have liked. It did stay largely flat. One thing to say, though, and this is not to justify a flat budget, but what is impressive is to see how more efficient PEPFAR has become. It was using data in new ways. So even though the funding was flat, over the last couple of years, they were able to do more by looking at new, innovative, more efficient models of delivery.
He's concerned, however, that funding may go from flat to reduced during a Donald Trump administration.
PEPFAR has been a critical bipartisan legacy of now two presidents, and we will push as hard as we possibly can as AVAC and with our partners, both in the U.S. and especially in the recipient countries in Africa, to really ensure that we don't step back from PEPFAR's great gains. And we will certainly be advocating with the Trump administration that this is a program that is delivering one of the greatest returns on investments. Will that message be heard? I don't know.
Warren says there was little, if any, indication during and after the campaign about President-elect Trump's stand on global HIV/AIDS assistance. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Ugandan authorities say tension is growing among South Sudanese refugees. They say there's been some violence between the Dinka and Nuer, who are living in camps after fleeing their homeland. Reporter Catherine Nambi has the story.
The Dinka support President Salva Kiir, while the Nuer lean towards former Vice President Riek Machar. Gilbert Olanya, a member of parliament from Amuro district that hosts some of these refugees, says the two tribes are oftentimes seen provoking each other.
What is making us so annoyed and so worried is that the differences they are having in their country between Dinka and the Nuer, they have brought that differences inside Uganda. As I talk now, if a Dinka meets a Nuer, you see them quarreling, you see them fighting. So our major concern as Uganda, we know all of them as refugees from Southern Sudan. They must not bring their differences or tribal conflict inside Uganda.
Uganda Police Force has resorted to the use of community policing in the camps and refugee host communities to help create harmony. Patrick Jimeokema is the Uganda Police spokesperson, a SWA region that hosts majority refugees.
We very much know that the best means of handling situations nowadays is community policing. We get some of these people who know, who understand their language. We talk to them. We have a team from Marua, West Nile. We have the support of UNHCR. We have Red Cross. We have Office of the Prime Minister. Ourselves as police, we are on the ground to see that we talk to these people. Others do not know why they have run away from their country. Much as they know there is war there, but they do not know exactly why they came. So that is one thing among other things that we are sharing to them, so that they exactly know what is happening. And we expect them to follow the norms and the rules that we have in Uganda in terms of the constitution, because they are part of us now. Since the government is well clear and interested to look after them.
Josephine Angushia, another police officer in the region, says they will not tire of preaching coexistence between the tribes.
We have also been emphasizing to them that they should leave their conflicts in Sudan. They should leave their intertribal conflicts in Sudan. Here, all of them are considered as the same who have sought refuge because of a common problem. So to treat each other as brothers and sisters on Ugandan soil, that is what we are trying to do.
She says Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister and UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, have separated the two tribes into different camps. The Dinka have been resettled in Rhino Camp, while the Nur are in Mvempi settlement. David Kazungu, the Commissioner for Refugees in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, warns that any South Sudan refugee caught fighting or destabilizing the camps will be punished according to Uganda's laws.
All the laws that govern security of Ugandans apply to the refugees. No refugees above the law, no refugees allowed to commit crimes, so they have to be charged according to the laws of Uganda. They are our guests here and they have to be governed by the laws of Uganda.
Meanwhile, the South Sudan community in the camps have mobilized themselves into a church whose message is peace and unity. The church is headed by Reverend Abraham Abik Arok from East Jonglei State in South Sudan.
I come and apply to my people. So my people, we sit down and we say we cannot get anything anywhere except we help ourselves. Now we don't have a place for prayer. Let us start contribute until the church stands. In fact, this church is changing a lot, because when the church stands, we sit and have a meeting. We start encourage our people, make a unity. It is become a place for peace.
Fighting between the Dinka and Nuer tribes has been at the center of the conflicts in the youngest African nation, South Sudan. For VOA, this is Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese refugees say they cannot get jobs at settlement camps in Uganda. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the last thing you do before you sleep?
Checking my emails, of course. And then sometimes I'm away from my family, so I call them if I'm abroad or, like, doing something. But if they're with me, I will kiss them goodnight and I will sing for them a little song. I mean, little ones, of course.
Prayer. I offer myself, I dedicate in prayer, then I rest to bed.
The last thing I do before I go to bed is I check on everybody in the house. Is everybody in? If they are all in, I go to bed.
I usually pray, then I call my sister and then we talk. Then usually I fall asleep while talking to her. Really, I usually would have like a cup of tea. I like having tea before I sleep.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese professionals who have sought refuge in Uganda because of the ongoing fighting and political instability in South Sudan said they are being denied jobs at refugee settlement camps, despite their qualifications in different fields. Bonifacio Taban has the details from Uganda's Kiryandongo district.
Monica Michael worked as a volunteer at Panyandole Health Center. He woke up at 6 o'clock every morning and walk about 30 kilometers to help hundreds of South Sudanese refugees in Panyandole 3 Health Center in Kiryandongo districts. She said It is the only health center offering pre-medical service to the southern of South Sudanese refugees. When he visited Panyandole for the first time seeking for medical treatment, Michael said he found many South Sudanese patients who could not communicate with the doctors due to the language barrier.
The time I reached to come, no, I don't have any work to do it. But after like 1 year, I become a volunteer because I saw my people they are like, you know, if you went to hospital and then there is no someone to punch your sickness, sometimes it's a very difficult to communicate with a doctor. So that's why I saw like that, I become interpreter.
But Michael has professional experience working as a nurse in Sudan for 2 years. He completed a nursing course in Afanail University from Khartoum. He said he has looked for a nursing job, but is not allowed to work in Uganda because he is a foreigner.
They know I tell them, and then sometimes also they see my work. Yeah, but here in Kam, actually, we have some issues. Yeah, they cannot allow it. There is some work they cannot allow a refugee to be, like a clinical officer, even though you are finished in Southern Sudan. They cannot. Nursing officer, midwife, data kilaka.
Despite the hardship of working on food every morning to work at the health center, Michael said he will not give up helping fellow refugees.
You start to work with a clinical officer around 7:30, sometime around 8. During the day up to around 5, sometimes 6. Like Monday, we are finished around 6:30. Without water, without food, without anything.
22 years old, James Ranloy is another volunteer who works at Real Medicine Foundation in Panyandole Health Center 3. Ran said he's volunteering to gain knowledge.
What motivates me, first of all, when I joined this work as an interpreter, at least now I have some knowledge about medicine, even though I've not done it as my professional course. But now I have a offer that I can do it. I never thought of doing it before, but now I feel I can do it.
Rand dropped out of his school almost 2 years ago, along with his brother's children, when he fled to Uganda to escape the fighting in South Sudan. He said after the conflict broke out in 2013, he lost contact with his brother. He has been supporting his brother's children ever since on the little money he received from volunteering at the camp.
Sometimes I feel bad as someone who is not married. Since it is first time for me to be responsible, I feel bad. But now I'm used to. I know the way I can make them happy. I know the way I can tell them, please, since we are in a problem, whatever we have, let's accept it.
Samir Adam sell a tea at Molokonyi Suburb at Molokonyi Cluster. She said the volunteers are offering a great service to the refugees in the camp. Speaking in Arabic, he said volunteers assist South Sudanese refugees, translating the problem of fashion to the doctors.
من كن يتكلم بكلام ناس الشغالين معنا في مسافة ده معامل.
I want to talk about those who are in the volunteer at the hospital. They are helpful to the patients here in the camp. Those who are camping and come to the resettlement and enter the hospital. If they find them, they help them by directing them to the doctor. But these people work only for the sake of God, and they have nothing for their own children. Their work is saving different tribes in their camp.
Many South Sudanese here at the Kiradongo settlement camp said the volunteers like Loy and Michael have helped them to communicate their illness to the Ugandan doctors, who then can prescribe the right drug for various diseases affecting the thousands of South Sudanese refugees streaming into Uganda. For VOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban reporting in Biala, Uganda.
An education specialist at the University of Juba says South Sudanese adopted much of their traditions and cultures from neighboring countries, where many sought refuge during decades of war in southern Sudan, then South Sudan. Lamora Frank says some of those cultural practices negatively affect the future of South Sudanese children, as we hear from Tito Justin for VOA from Juba.
By definition, culture is a way of life of a society or community. It includes the food people eat, the clothes they wear, and the religion they believe. Lecturer Lomoro Frank says most of the cultural activities in South Sudan are copied from neighboring countries.
Previously, we had lived in different environments. So some people have been to the East African countries, others have been to Khartoum, others have been in Ethiopia or in US or in Europe. So coming back, we tend to submit to certain forms of practices which we think are best because we borrowed them and they are not from, for example, a fellow ethnic group in South Sudan.
29-year-old Bol Yuol Gabriel is from Jongole and was raised in Kenya's town of Eldoret, where he learned some of the Kikuyu cultures and Kalenjin communities. Now that Gabriel is living in South Sudan, he says he knows nothing about his own culture and wants to learn all that he can.
It's not that good that if you don't know about your culture, but I'm just a little bit trying. I learned a culture of the place where I was staying, like, let me say, Kenya, this is where I'm just trying. But our culture, I'm now a little bit just trying to learn about it.
Frank says there is really nothing that can be identified as purely South Sudanese culture. He says South Sudanese citizens have copied cultures from Sudan, from East Africa in general, and even some from the modern Western world.
Ask yourself today, what is the common dressing code of South Sudanese? It's difficult for somebody from Equatoria or from maybe from Upper Nile. I hear about Lao and the other kinds of dressings for women, but from Equatoria, these kind of dressings are not clear to our children who are below 18. Actually, in most cases, people go modern.
As children grew up, Frank says, they are influenced by technology which is based on a foreign culture. He says the toy cars, toy guns, and dolls that South Sudanese children play with make it difficult for them to learn their parents' culture.
The influx of foreign cultures have put our children at a point when they are not able to think, to reason out solutions for their society. You will believe with me, up to the university, it is difficult for somebody to think of inventing anything. People believe already everything is coming from Japan, everything is coming from the US.
Frank says, at times in South Sudan, different cultures are looked upon as the culture of the enemy and are politicized. He says, children often grew up worried about practicing their own culture, thinking it may be seen as a threat or looked upon as a dubious culture.
I would choose that in the schools that our children go to, we need to be able to practice some of these cultures and tell children what is positive about their culture. This is one. Two, the competition, the cultural competitions taking place in terms of music, dance, dramas, and so on, shouldn't be discussing negative elements. For example, the practice of war. For example, we should be able to use our traditional technologies, how we made tools in the past, and improve on this so that we can be able to show the world the positive part of our cultures.
And Frank says foreign films shown in the theater and music and dramas that air on local radio and television stations are the most silent aspects of South Sudanese identity which all citizens need to learn from. Frank says, unless there is a deliberate attempt to teach South Sudanese children their culture, in 20 years to come, most of the younger generation will not know their own culture. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
This year's Mr. Africa International is South Sudanese native Akol Duk, who lives in the Midwest U.S. state of Iowa. Duk took home first place this year in the competition held in London in October. With just a couple of months into his reign, Duk says he hopes to use his newfound platform to bring attention to the crisis in his home country.
First of all, it was very humbling, and the best part of all is that I was representing the South Sudan flag. And, you know, considering what's going on in South Sudan, that was a great way to really push myself and South Sudan, because I was with people from Nigeria, Ghana, countries who have a positive light behind them in entertainment and in music and in fashion. And I actually competed against, you know, a Ghanaian actor who does movies, a Nigerian model, a bodybuilder from Madagascar. So, and many people who are doing great things in their field, in their nature. So it gave me confidence in myself and belief in my abilities to say, if I can compete with these people, I can compete with anybody.
What do you think is the best way for us to tell our own stories and to put our own image out there?
It has to start with self-value. And I think self-value is how you portray yourself. And the example I always give is how we even introduce ourselves to people. You know, when, you know, those of us who have a really African tribal name, you know, we like to change, you know, like growing up, you know, my name's Akol, you know, but people call me Akol, Akol. And I realized a lot of Africans around me, we've bended our names to accommodate the Westerners. So I said, we portray ourselves in a positive light, and we say our culture is positive in life. And we see this recently with things going on. For example, in South Sudan, we see tribal issues going on. People don't talk about the positive things about what tribes used to do, the positive things about how tribes had a civilization. We necessarily refer to the negative. So we have to represent ourselves with pride and be proud of our background and our heritage and understand where we come from, not in a sense of just as Africans, but as the small groups that make up Africa and the small groups that make up our nations and our groups.
When I speak to a lot of young people in the diaspora, they talk mm-hmm. about basically growing up with two different identities and trying to grow in your culture and embrace it, mm-hmm. but at the same time struggling to find your American identity or struggling to fit in the West. Mm-hmm. Have you had those same struggles?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the example I always give is, so I went to Sudan in 2006. When I was there, I was teased because my Tomonjan wasn't as good as it should be. So they said, you know, you became Khawaja, you're Americanized, and, you know, and that I took that personally. To me, even that's something that bothers me, that my mother tongue isn't the language I speak best. You know, I can speak it, but not to the degree I can speak, say, in English or Arabic. And so growing up here, the identity crisis was, what am I? You know, to African-Americans, I'm not African-American. I'm an African. To Africans in Africa, you know, I'm an American. But my parents, they, you know, my parents speak our tribal language fluently. They can tell stories in this. And trying to understand that was hard, because at home you speak it here and there. You know, they tell you, they talk to you, and but it wasn't, you weren't fully immersed in it. So when you go out and meet other South Sudanese or Africans, you're like, whoa, we're having the same problem, because we spend 8 hours a day in school speaking English, and we come home, we get yelled at because we don't know our language. We don't know our identity. We don't know our culture. And I remember my parents would always say, that's not our culture. That's not our identity. I was like, look, I don't know what our culture and identity is. And that prompted me to try to understand the history, the identity, where I come from, because I was like, I want to know my background. I want to know who I am. And I told myself, you know, I vowed to say, my name is Akol, you know, Akol Nyong, Akol Dok, you know, and I vowed to take, you know, strive to improving speaking my mother tongue, to understand where I come from, to understand the people I represent. You know, I want to know what my roots, my ancestors, my great-grandfathers, what did they do? And it became almost a spiritual journey that I began to embark on, because that identity crisis really, you know, it makes a lot of people feel insecure, and it takes away your value because you don't know where to fit in.
That's Akol Dok speaking to me from his home state of Iowa here in the U.S. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Shaquille Manga by General Paulino. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sibuta kunjambana, anal bagar posi. Shikili manga zatu, lide ati belajia sibuta kunjambana, anal bagar posi.